One of the things I said was that they had various different names, right? One of the names was stabilizer codes, which is justified because we like to talk about those stabilizers. Another name was symplectic codes. And that, if you recall, was because if we convert the Pauli operators into binary vectors, 2n dimensional binary vectors, then the commutivity property becomes a symplectic inner product being zero. And thus the name symplectic. And so the third name I mentioned was there were sometimes called additive codes or additive GF4 codes. And so the first thing I'd like to talk about is why that name is used. So what is GF4, first of all? So the GF4 is a finite field with four elements. And it turns out that up to kind of the obvious definition of isomorphism, there is only one finite field with four elements. In fact, there is only one finite field with any particular number of elements. Finite fields have to have a power, have a size that's a power of a prime, and there's only one field of that size. But today I'm only going to be interested in GF4. So what is a field? Well, it's defined, at least, in the notes that I put on the website with background on group theory. But just to remind you, field is one of these algebraic objects that has an addition and the multiplication. And the field is a group under addition. And the field has a zero for addition. But if you throw that away, then it's also the remainder of the field is a group on the multiplication. And what's more, they're both abelian groups. So both of these things, addition and multiplication, are commutative. And the one additional property that you have is the distributive law. Which relates addition and multiplication, right? So you know what that is, probably. It's A times B plus C is equal to AB plus AC. Okay? And fields are very familiar to you, of course, because the real numbers are field, the complex numbers are field, the rational numbers are field. But those are all infinite fields. And in fact, you've already been working with a field, which is Z2, right? 0 and 1 form a field, because you can add 0 and 1, right? 0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 1 is 0. And you can multiply them, right? 1 times 1 is 1. It's just not very interesting to do that. So there's not many possibilities. And so Z2 is a finite field with two elements. Finite fields are a little bit different from the infinite fields that you're used to. Finite fields have what's called a characteristic. So GF4 is a field of characteristic 2. Now what does that mean? Well, for a finite field, since it only has a finite number of elements, if you just add something to itself continuously or repeatedly, then eventually you'll get back to zero. Okay? And it has to be that way because, remember, addition is invertible. So eventually you have to get back, in particular, you have to get back to where you started. And if you do one less than that, you'll be zero, right? So for GF4, so what's not so obvious is that it's always the same number of times. For any element except zero, you add it to itself some particular number of times, and you get back to zero. And I said finite fields have a size that's the power of a prime, and it turns out the characteristic is that prime. So for GF4, that means it has characteristic 2, right? Which in particular means that for all x in the field, x plus x is equal to 0. Okay, So since this is a field that's a power of 2, kind of addition and subtraction are the same thing. Okay? In general, we can, well, we're not talking about in general, we're talking about GF4 in specific. And so the elements of GF4, there's going to be 4 of them, of course. And so we're going to write them this way. Well, first of all, we need a 0, right? Because addition has to be a group, so we need something that's the identity for addition. And similarly, multiplication is a group, so we need an identity for multiplication, so that's 1, of course. And then we have 2 more elements. And we're going to call them omega and omega squared, with omega squared obviously equal to omega times omega. But there have to be other relations between those. So we can have to fill out the addition and multiplication tables. And it turns out that basically we just need 2 more relations. So one of them is this, 1 plus omega is equal to omega squared. Okay. And the other one is omega cubed is equal to 1. So we can think of this as GF4 is the binary field, 0 and 1, when we adjoin an additional element that's a cube root of 1. And of course, there's 2 cube roots of 1, right? So it's e to the 2 pi over 3 and e to the 4 pi over 3. And so kind of those are the 2 things, omega and omega squared. And if you add up all the roots of 1, you get 0 again. So that's what this equation says. 1 plus omega squared is equal to 0. Right? Again, because this is characteristic 2. So we can subtract omega squared from left. It's just same as adding. OK? OK. So we can think of GF4 also as, this is kind of an equivalent way to think about it. GF4 is a two-dimensional vector space over the field with 2 elements. Okay, so we can think of X in GF4 as something of the form A plus B omega, where A, B are bits. Okay? And so, of course, you can just immediately see that 0 corresponds to the vector 0, 0. 1 corresponds to the vector 1, 0. Omega corresponds clearly to the vector 0, 1. And omega squared is kind of the only non-trivial one. And we use this relation to see that omega squared corresponds to the vector 1, 1. Right? And since each of these are just 0 and 1, those are all the possibilities. Okay. So there's kind of 2 more basic properties of this field, which are not quite as basic as the things I've gone through, but are going to be important in once we start to make the connection to stabilizers. So what are those? Well, so let's see. So put one of them on the left and one of them on the right. So first, there's kind of a symmetry in GF4 between omega and omega squared. Right? We could have kind of chosen, I mean, when we choose the cube root of unity that we're adding to this field, we could have switched them, right? It's kind of no way of knowing a priori which one is which. It's kind of like switching I to minus I. In fact, if you think of them as e to the 2 pi over 3, that's exactly what we're doing. So that's a conjugation property. And so conjugation is going to be an operation that I'm going to define on GF4. And it's just going to take, I'm going to write it by a line over the number. And it's going to take 0 to 0 and 1 to 1. But it's going to switch omega to omega squared. Okay? So that's a pretty straightforward thing to calculate. The other one is maybe in some ways a little more surprising. Remember, since I said that this GF4 is a two-dimensional vector space over Z2, well, what is addition then in this field? It's just addition in this vector space, right? That's clear. You can think of that. You can see that right off. But multiplication is something that's more interesting. So using this picture, multiplication by some element of GF4 corresponds to multiplication by some matrix. That depends on x. And so you can calculate what m sub x is for the different elements of the field. So 0 and 1 are kind of obvious. 0 multiplication by 0 gives you just 0, right? So it could be the 0 matrix. And multiplication by 1 leaves it the same, so it could be the identity matrix. But omega and omega squared are a little more interesting, and you can work them out. So for example, let's calculate the matrix that corresponds to omega, multiplication by omega. Well, what does it do? It takes the vector 1, 0, right, so that's just 1, to omega, which is a vector 0, 1. Right, so 1, 0 should go to 0, 1. And the vector 0, 1, which is omega, goes to omega squared, which we know is 1, 1. So 0, 1 goes to 1, 1. Right? Does everyone see that? Okay. So once we have these matrices, we can define something which is the trace. Oh, okay. So we'll have trace of x is equal to the trace of this matrix mx, right? And it turns out that you can calculate this in general is equal to x plus x squared for GF4. Okay, that's not so obvious that you can just write it out. Yeah?
I think I completely missed something. So you said, so 1 should go, 0, sorry. 1 should go to omega for your matrix.
Yeah, so this matrix is the thing that you get when you multiply by omega. So you have some other element of the field. You want to calculate x times y for some y. And you try it for different y's, and you see what you get. Okay?
Yeah.
Oh, and I guess I didn't say this, but it's not actually immediately obvious that it actually corresponds to a matrix. Right? It might be, I mean, you have lots of, in general, for a general finite field, you have, you know, some enormous number of elements. And maybe you're doing some other, and this matrix is just, so if you have like a p squared, a field the size of p squared, you could somehow be mixing up all those p squared elements in some weird way. But this, I'm just saying, is going to be a p by p matrix. Right? So why is it that we can write it that way? And the answer is because of the distributive law that forces this to be a linear operation, right? Because if you add, so you have x on the left here, and you're adding two different things, y and z here, well, then the result is the sum of those. So that means that the left multiplication by an element is a linear operation. And similarly, right multiplication, of course, is commutative. Okay, so anyway, so you have this matrix, you can take the trace. So let's do that. So we have four possibilities. So trace 0, well, that's clearly just 0. And trace 1, that's the identity. So it's 1 plus 1 is also 0. And it turns out that trace omega, well, you can look at it, that's 1, is equal to trace omega squared. Okay. So the trace, by the way, is back in the original, what's called the base field, Z2 in this case. So trace is a way of going from this GF4 element back to a bit. And that's why it's going to be useful to us. Okay. What we won't use that for. Okay. So so any other questions on GF4? Yeah.
I guess like the way I've seen this before is you write it as polynomials module x squared in base field.
That's right. So
is there any reason you chose this as opposed to that other representation?
Well, so that's kind of the general structure for how you create these bigger fields. Like I said, it turns out that there's only one field of a given size. So in that sense, it doesn't matter so much exactly what polynomials you choose, although there's restrictions, right? You have to choose irreducible polynomials and so on. So in this case, omega, you're joining one of those two equations that I wrote down, either the 1 plus omega squared equals 0, or, I guess omega cubed equals 1 factors into that. So omega cubed plus 1 is non-irreducible. So you're joining the first equation, basically. And the root of the first equation is omega.
So can you always do this for an arbitrarily sized finite field? Can you always find this representation as primitive roots of unity to all the elements?
I don't think so. Because in general, if you have omega to the n minus 1, you can factor it into omega minus 1 times 1 plus omega squared, et cetera, up to omega to the n minus 1. But the problem is that that's not always an irreducible polynomial. So in the case of GF4, it was. I mean, starting from Z2, it was. But for other fields, it might not be. In that case, you can't. So it doesn't represent this way. But the properties, there is something like conjugation, although the connection to stabilizer code starts to become iffier. Well, we'll talk about higher dimensions later. Although I'm not sure if we'll go into that. Probably not. But there is a definition of trace that's basically the same, because that didn't depend on kind of any of these more detailed properties of the field, just the fact that you could write it as this linear vector space. Although the equation x plus x squared has to be replaced by something else. Okay. But for now, I'm just thinking about GF4, so you only need to know these specific elements and specific properties of them. Okay? So let's go on. Okay, so what's the connection with stabilizer codes? Sorry, was there another question?
No.
Okay. So what's the connection with stabilizer codes? Well, it seems silly, but there's four elements of GF4, and there's four polymatrices on a single qubit. And that's the connection. Okay, so what are we going to do? Is just set up some direct connection here. We're going to say, well, clearly zero is kind of special, and identity is kind of special. So we'll put a line between those two. We'll say they're the same. And what are the other polys? Well, we have x. Let's assign that to 1. Z we'll assign to omega. And then y has to get stuck with omega squared. Y is always left out. Okay? So this is kind of arbitrary. The I to 0 connection, that's important. But the others could be in any order. It's just this is a convenient one, so let's use this. Okay? And then when you do this, we see that multiplication over here corresponds to addition over here. Right? Because, well, so if you take x times z, you get y, or minus iy, anyway. And 1 plus omega, that's omega squared. And simply anything times the identity is itself. Right? That's why we had to have the identity go to 0. But in general, if you add two of these things, you'll get the third one as a result of the 1 plus omega squared equals 0 equation. And simply if you add multiply two of these things, you'll get the third one. Up to a phase. And so again, just like when we went to these 2n bit vectors, the phases in the Pauli group have disappeared. So they don't correspond to anything over here. Okay? So as long as, remember, of course, the things like the distance of the code didn't really depend on keeping track of those phases. So that's why it's still an interesting thing to do if we're interested in the basic properties of the quantum Arbitrary code. We can, well, what we're going to do is there's a lot of classical work on codes over finite fields larger than binary fields. And in particular, we can take codes over the finite field GF4 and convert them into quantum codes. And I'll show you an example of that in a little bit. Okay? But in order to do that, remember, well, we have the same problem that we had before when we went to the binary vectors. When we lose the phases, we lose this commutativity property. And we need, that is important. So we need something to replace that. So what is commutativity here? And so let's figure that out. Well, motivated by this binary vector space thing, we have, again, some inner product. And what is that inner product? Well, that's more complicated. So we can write it down in terms of these two things that I wrote up there, right? There had to be a reason for that. I mean, I made you some things for no reason, but I was very specific that there was a reason in this case. Okay, so in particular, we find that, suppose we have two Pauli things, operators, that correspond to two vectors over GF4. Okay, so GF4 to the n is the vector space whose components are all elements of GF4, right? So we have basically just a list of n GF4 elements. And you can see that if we have an n qubit Pauli operation, we can just convert that to a n bit or n quart vector over GF4, right, by just converting each component individually. Okay? So we're going to do that. And then we find that P and Q commute if and only if this expression, trace of U dot V bar, is equal to 0. Okay? So this requires some verification. Probably the easiest way is just to try everything. I'm not going to go through all of those for you. You can do that yourself. But you can see, for instance, let's just think about a single qubit converted into a four-state thing. So you can see, for instance, if so we have u dot v bar, and you can see if one of those is 0, like u is 0, well, then the product of that with v bar will obviously be 0 also. And then the trace of 0 is 0. So the identity will commute with anything. On the other hand, if we have, say, x and z, well, OK, so let's plug in x here is 1, z here is omega. But omega bar is omega squared. So we get 1 times omega squared. And trace of omega squared, look up there, if you can see it, that's 1. Right? So since the trace is 1, they don't commute, which is correct. And you can try out all the other combinations. And it turns out this always works. Yeah?
If you assign the Pauli matrices in a different order, is the two equations still the same? Or do you have to
Yep. And actually, you can see that has to be true, right? Because commutativity and anti-commutativity only depend on whether they're the same or not. Right? And rearranging these things, therefore, can't change that, right? So if this is true for one arrangement, it has to be true that this only depends on whether u and v are the same at that place or not. So all of this gets more complicated in higher dimensions. But again, that's something we'll talk about later. Or maybe avoid talking about. But we will talk about higher dimensions later, just maybe not the connections to finite fields. Okay. So this is the inner product that we want to use. Yeah.
So when you say the multiplication goes to addition, it just means that multiplication on the left hand side means that we add the two elements on the right hand side.
That's right. Yeah.
What we get is what we get. So then commutativity here would just come from the commutativity.
That's the point. That's the point. Because on the left hand side, commutativity is, since these are poly operators, things either commute or anti-commute. And the difference between those plus or minus one is an overall phase. But phases, remember, don't correspond to anything over here. They're dropped. They disappear. Right? So like plus x and minus x both go to one. Okay? So that's the sense in which if we didn't do anything, I mean, so addition here is always commutative.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's a field. But multiplication here is not because of these phases. And so what's the difference between those? Well, it's the phases. And to restore that, our knowledge of that property, we have to use this inner product.
So basically, minus x or something would also go to 1.
Minus x would also go to 1. That's right. Other questions?
What about multiplication? GF4.
Multiplication in GF4. Very good question. Well, let's think of some simple examples. Multiplication by zero. What does that do? It takes everything to zero. Okay? Well, I'm not sure exactly. We haven't seen an operation like that in the polys. Multiplication by one, well, that's relatively easy, right? It takes everything to itself. So it's multiplication by one is kind of doing nothing in the poly. So, but there's no pattern here. I mean, these are just different things. So really, you could think multiplication here corresponds to nothing over here. It's not really a meaningful operation. But we can look at multiplication by specific elements. And in particular, and the only interesting one is omega. I mean, omega squared is interesting too, but it's symmetric. Okay. So what is multiplication by omega in GF4 correspond to under the polys? Well, we can work it out, right? So it's taking 1 to omega, and omega goes to omega squared, and omega squared goes to omega cubed, which is 1 again, and of course 0 goes to 0. So what it's doing is it's taking x to z, z to y, and then y back to x. Turns out there's some overall phase here, I think. It's minus x. But, there has to be a phase somewhere here, I think. But that as turns out, is not very important. Anyway, so the point is this is some kind of permutation of the polys, in particular cyclic permutation. And so the property of multiplying by omega means that we have this kind of symmetry of the polys, which is going to show up in just a minute once we start to talk about codes. Yeah?
So then, earlier we have seen this poly matrices as a group, right? So here you want to do it as a field? Or as a group?
Well, so that's the point, is... we are thinking of GF4 as a field, but kind of one of the important properties of the field, multiplication, is a new one. It's giving us extra structure. So sometimes we want to use it, and sometimes we won't. And I'll come back to this again in a minute once I talk about codes. Okay. So why don't we do that? Okay, so before I defined a linear code, that was kind of in a way that was kind of specialized for binary fields. So a linear code in GF4 is going to be very similar, but it has to be linear in the GF4 sense. So before, I just said that the sum of two code words had to be in the code. So now we have x and y in the code. But now it has to be true that the sum is in the code, but also scalar multiples. So maybe I'll write these as vectors to make it clear that they're in the code. And so x plus alpha y is in the code when alpha is just some element of GF4. Right, so before we didn't have to worry about that because the only possibilities alphas in Z2 are 0 and 1. Right, so it's either you add or you don't. But in this case, we have to think about multiplication by omega and omega squared, as well as just addition. So this is a linear code, but you can also define an additive code. And that's just kind of the obvious thing, which is that we don't worry about scalar multiplication. We say that x and y are in C implies that the sum is in C. But we don't make any constraint about what happens when we multiply by omega. And so what we find is that the general stabilizer code is going to correspond under this replacement to just an additive GF4 code. Thus the name, additive codes or additive GF4 codes. Okay? But of course, the stabilizer is not just any set of, doesn't give you just any set of vectors. The stabilizer has to be abelian. So this is an additive GF4 code. That's what's called, so it's a little complicated. So let's say that it's a code that's weakly self-dual under this particular inner product. Okay, so what do I mean by that? The dual code C perp in this case is equal to the set of vectors x such that x dot y is equal to 0. Okay, So let me put a circle around this dot to indicate that it's the special inner product. Oh, sorry. So this could be true for all y in the code. And so this special inner product is equal to what I had over there, trace x dot y bar. Okay? And weakly self-dual then says that C is included in C perp. In other words, what this is saying is weakly self-dual means that all of the vectors in this code are orthogonal to all the other vectors in the code under this inner product, right? Which is just the property we wanted. Because this inner product says these things commute. And therefore, this condition of being weakly self-dual under this particular inner product says that the stabilizer is abelian. Right? And so if you think about it, this thing C perp clearly is doing something important, and if you translate this definition back onto the Pauli operator side, You see that C perp is just a set of poly operators that commute with everything in the stabilizer, right? Everyone see that? So so this thing N of S that I defined last time is the poly version of this C perp. And remember that the distance of the stabilizer code was equal to the smallest weight thing in N of S minus S. So that's what we have here, is the distance is equal to the minimum weight of X, where X is in C perp minus C. And again, we have this phenomenon of degeneracy. So normally, if we had a linear code C perp, or an additive code C perp, we could define its distance to be the smallest weight non-zero vector in it. Smallest weight of a non-zero vector in it, right? Just like over a binary field. But in this case, we have the distances potentially larger than that, because we're getting rid of this original code C. Okay? If you remember, we talked about degeneracy last time and had a problem. Okay? Okay. So I said what we could do is we could take advantage of some of the classical work on codes over GF4 and use them to make quantum codes. So let's do that now. So in particular, you remember last time I talked about the binary Hamming codes. The 7-bit code was an example. We could use that to make CSS code, the 7-qubit code. Well, it turns out there's Hamming codes over other finite fields also. And over GF4, these are pretty interesting for the quantum case. So remember, we defined the Hamming code before by saying we wanted the parity check matrix to, well, so for distance 3 code, we need the columns, any two columns in the parity check matrix to be linearly independent. That's still true here. But now linear independence means, so the Hamming codes are going to be linear codes, by the way. Not just additive codes. And of course, linear codes are subset of additive codes, so it's fine. We may still be able to convert those to quantum codes if we have this weakly self-dual condition. So now linear independence of these columns means we have to take into account multiplication by omega and omega squared. So so let's take the two-row parity check matrix. For one of these Hamming codes. And remember, what we did in the Hamming code case is just we wrote all possible vectors that were going to be linearly independent. So how are we going to do that here? Well, the first one we can write is 0, 1. That's purely independent from itself. But now we can't write 0, omega, right? Because that would be this times a scalar factor. What we can do is we can write 1, 0. That's fine.
Daniel, what's the length of the code?
So that's what we're going to work out. So what we're going to do is we're going to write all the columns that we can. And what we want is we want that each new column that we write be linearly independent, not from all of the previous columns, but from any single one of them. So no new column could be a scalar multiple of a previous column. So what we can do is we've done this, we've done this. We can also write 1-1. That's fine. Right? So it's this plus this column is equal to this plus this. So that's why I was confused for a moment. But it's not equal to a scalar multiple of this or this. So that's OK. And similarly, we can write 1 omega, 1 omega squared. Clearly, neither of these can possibly be gotten from a scalar multiple of any of the earlier ones. But now we might say, well, OK, so let's try to write omega something down here. But you'll see that we can't do that, right? Because omega anything, we could get, well, so omega, whatever is down here, we could divide this thing by omega and the top by omega, and we get back one of these four possibilities, right? So this is it. We're out of columns that we can write. So what we've got is we've got two rows. We've got five columns now, so n is equal to 5. And so two parity checks, 5 registers means we have 3 encoded GF4 things. And this is a distance 3 code. And then I'm going to write a subscript 4 to remind us that it's over the finite field with 4 elements. Okay, so this is a classical linear code. And it turns out, you can calculate yourself, that this is a weakly self-dual code. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're then going to convert it back into a stabilizer code. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, we change 0 to I, 1 to X, omega to Z, I guess, and omega squared to Y. But we have to be careful of something. Since this is a linear code, and this linearity property kind of doesn't translate immediately to quantum code, we have to be careful to include multiplications by omega as well. So what we're going to do is, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to convert this from linear code to an additive code.
How did you get the distance of the code?
So remember this was, you weren't here, but so last time I showed that, at least for binary codes, and it also holds for GF4 codes, that the distance is of a classical code is the minimum number of columns of the parity check matrix that are linearly dependent. Okay, so by having, in this case, we chose all the columns to be different so that any two of them are linearly independent. And so that means the distance has to be 3. And this, I should say, is the parity check matrix. So maybe I need to be more explicit about this. Because the distance of this code is going to be based on the distance of C per, right, on the upper board. I want to convert the parity check matrix of C perp, which is C, where the generator matrix is C, into the stabilizer. OK, so that's what we're going to do. And so first, we want to convert this into an additive code. So what does that mean? Well, so certainly we have this in there. But we also have this in the code, omega, 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 omega. Right, which is this times omega. So we didn't need it up here when we were thinking of this as a linear code because it was redundant. But now we do. Okay? But what we don't need is 0 omega squared, omega squared, omega squared, omega squared. Why is that? Well, remember, omega squared is equal to 1 plus omega. So if we add this and this, we would get the thing I just said. Right? So by throwing in this thing, we're done, at least for the first two. But we have to do the same thing for the second one, second row, omega, omega squared. So that gives us omega, 0, omega, omega squared, 1. And for the same reason, we don't have to think about omega squared times this. Okay. And then what we're going to do is we convert this into a quantum code using the things on the left board. So we get the first generator is going to be I, x, 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 x. The second will be I, Z, 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 Z. The third, X, I, X, Z, Y. And the fourth will be Z, I, Z, Y, I. Okay? Somebody didn't seem happy with that. I heard a...
One is X at the bottom of the right corner.
Yes, you're right. You're right not to be happy. Okay? And so what are the parameters in this code? Well, so it's a quantum code. It's a stabilizer code. It has 5 qubits. It has 4 generators. So that means it has 1 encoded qubit. And what is its distance? Well, its distance has to be at least as large as the distance of C perp, the classical code we started out with, which is 3. So there's I'm slipping over something here, but we'll get back to that in a second. Okay, so this turns out to be a 5-1-3 quantum code. Of course, you're already seeing a 5-1-3 quantum code, right? There's a 5-qubit code from last time. And it turns out, in fact, that this is equivalent up to local unitary transformations. But this is the way you could have derived it from knowing about classical codes. 5-qubit code is not so hard. You can write it down. I mean, once you have stabilized formalism, you can write it down trial and error. It takes only a little while to find. But you can use the same property to make bigger Hamming codes. Okay? So in particular, let's think about if we have 3 or more rows in this parity technique. Well, before I do that, does anyone understand this construction? Are there questions on it? Okay, so bigger Hamming codes. Let's consider R rows of the parity check matrix. And try to figure out how many columns we can get this way. Well, one thing we can do is we can look at vectors of this form. Where x here is in the r minus 1 row Hamming code. Right? And clearly these are all independent of each other, right? Because they're just the same things as before. Right? Everyone agree to that? And then we can take 1 up here and something down here and get things that are independent of these, clearly, because no scalar multiple of these things will give us a 1 up there. And since this 1 is fixed, they're not going to be, we can take all sorts of different things down here, and they're never going to be scalar multiples of each other either, right? Because otherwise we'd have to change the top one. So what we can do is we can take 1 y, where now y is some element. Well, it's a vector, so it's gf4 to the r minus 1. And it could be anything, and they're all different. Okay? But that's it. By the same argument as before, right? If we had omega times anything down here, well, we could divide through by omega and get back something of this form. Or simply omega squared and something. So this is it. So what this tells us is that n for r is equal to the number of columns we get for the r minus 1 Hamming code plus 4 to the r minus 1, right? Because that's how many possibility values there are for y. Okay? In other words, this is equal to 1 plus 4 plus 4 squared plus all the way up to 4 to the r minus 1. So geometric series, we can sum it, we get 4 to the r minus 1 over 4 minus 1, which I'm sure you can see is equal to 3. Okay? So this is how many rows we have for the arc Hamming code. Or at least, well, okay, that's how you count. So in other words, we have these GF4 Hamming codes will have these parameters. 4 to the r minus 1 over 3. 4 to the r minus 1 over 3 minus r, encoded states, and distance 3. Okay? And then again, it turns out these are all symplectically self-dual codes. And so we can convert them to quantum codes. And what do we get? Well, we get codes with these parameters. Still 4 to the r minus 1 over 3 here, the number of qubits. But how many encoded qubits are there going to be? Well, you have to be careful there, because remember, this is a linear code. And so we have to do the same thing of converting it to an additive code. So when we had r rows of the parity step matrix before, now we have 2 r generators of the stabilizer. But the same thing, we have to multiply by omega, but not omega squared. That's redundant. So we have 2 r elements of the generator of the stabilizer. So that means that we'll have 4 to the r minus 1 over 3 minus 2 r. encoded qubits, and distance will again be 3. So now I'd like to point out a nice property of these things. So this is distance 3, right? So the number, so we have to, we're correcting all single qubit errors. And how many single qubit errors are there? Well, there's 3n plus 1 single qubit errors. And we have two to the k encoded basis states. And so what happens is that, I guess I don't need to do that. So we have two R stabilizer generators. And so we have 2 to the 2 R error syndromes. But let's see what's 3n plus 1. Well, here's n. 3n is 4 to the R minus 1, so 3n plus 1 is equal to 4 to the r, right? 2 to the 2 r. So the number of error syndromes is exactly equal to the number of errors. Right? So in fact, not only is this code non-degenerate, but we're exactly using up all of the error syndromes when we try to correct one error. So this is what's called a perfect code. And if we plug in the parameters, we'll see, well, okay, so r equals 2, that gave us the 513 code. What about r equals 3? Well, okay, so that's 4 cubed is 64 minus 163 divided by 3, so it's 21 qubits. And then we have to subtract off 6 to get 15 encoded qubits and distance 3. And r equals 4, but what do we get? So 4 to the 4th is 256 minus 1 is 255 divided by 3 is 85. And then we have to subtract off 8. So we have 77 encoded qubits, and again, distance 3. So as you can see, as these get higher and higher, we get more and more efficient codes. Of course, they still only correct one error. And when you have 85 qubits, the error rate has to be pretty low so that you have a good chance of having only one error. But still, as the error rate gets lower and lower, these can be very useful codes. Okay? So there are questions on that? One's plus two. Okay. So now let's do one last thing for GF4 codes, which is the thing I was kind of sloughing over before, which is the difference between the symplectically self-dual, this special inner product, and the regular self-duality. So it turns out. So for linear GF4 code, the property of being weakly self-dual under the special inner product is equivalent to the property being weakly self-dual under a more normal inner product without the trace. So. So now I'm going to get rid of those vectors because they make it kind of hard to see. So this is true for all u in the code. This is for a linear code. And that's equivalent to this being true for all u in the code. Okay? So how do you see that? Well, this direction is very easy, right? Because obviously, if this is equal to 0, then trace of 0 is 0. So. So let's go the other way. So suppose we have trace u dot v bar is equal to 0 for some particular u and v. And let's write u dot v bar in terms of this binary vector expansion of GF4. So we could write it a plus b omega. Okay? Well, then trace of this is 0, right? And trace is a linear operation. So this is equal to trace of a plus trace of b omega. Oh, and a and b here are bits. Trace of A, well, that's always just 0, whether it's 0 or 1. And trace of B omega, well, if B is 0, clearly it's 0. And if B is 1, trace of omega is 1. So this trace of U dot V is equal to B, which we then know is equal to 0. Okay? Right? Okay, but we know this is true for all u in the code. So we also know that trace of omega u dot v bar is equal to 0. Because it's a linear code, and if u is in the code, then omega u is in the code. And omega u, well, that's equal to omega times this. Sorry, omega u dot v bar is omega times this thing, a plus b omega, except we don't need to include b because b is 0. And omega a, well, trace of omega a is, again, going to be a. And therefore, a has to be 0 also. Right, and therefore, u dot v bar is equal to 0. Okay? So for linear codes, we don't have to check this trace inner product. We can just calculate this more normal inner product. Okay, so that's why it was okay to do what I did and just say, well, the distance of this code, of the quantum code, is equal to the distance of a classical code. If this hadn't been true, if we'd been working really with an additive code rather than linear code, then we'd have to make sure that the problem is that this thing I did for the distance was for the regular dual, not for the special dual. And so we needed to make sure that the distance was the same for the regular dual as for the special dual, for this guarantees. Okay? Okay, so are there any questions on that? Or on the GF4 codes in general? No? Okay, so then let's move on to a new topic. So what I'd like to talk about next is really a kind of big topic, so we're going to be continuing on to it into the next half of the class. But one motivation for it is to think about encoding circuits for stabilizer codes. We'd like to be able to say, well, here's the stabilizer. What's a series of simple gates we can do that will take an unencoded state and convert it into an encoded state? Well, the unencoded state, right, is going to be some number of qubits and some number of zeros. Some number of zeros, that's a stabilizer code also. It doesn't have any good distance, right, because the qubits are unencoded. But we could still write it down, and the stabilizer is just a bunch of z's, right, on the qubits that are all zeros. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to take some operation, this encoding circuit, that takes one stabilizer code into another stabilizer code. And so that's the this general class of operations has actually a lot of applications, some of which we'll see today, some of which we'll see later on in the course, some of which you'll see on the problem set, some of which you won't see. So that's what we're going to study for the moment. And so this in particular, we're going to study a set of operations called the Clifford group. Let's see, do I want to find it yet? No, not yet. Okay, so in particular, I'm asking the question, how do we convert? We convert one stabilizer code to another. And we're going to think about unitary operations. And so in particular, we want to ask, what happens if we apply unitary operations? What happens to the stabilizer? So suppose we have some state psi that's in the code space of some stabilizer code. And we're interested in u psi. The question is, what's going to be the stabilizer of u psi? Okay, well, so let's think about individual elements of the stabilizer. Let's do it this way. So we know that m psi is equal to psi, right, kind of by definition. And what we'd like to do is somehow get a u inside here. So what happens if we just expand u as unitary, so we can stick u dagger u here? So that's not doing anything, right? And that tells us that u, if we multiply that on the left by u, we get u m u dagger u psi is equal to u psi. Okay? In other words, psi started out as a plus 1 eigenstate of m, and therefore u psi is a plus 1 eigenstate of u, m, u dagger. So this is giving us a hint of what we could do. We could take the elements of the original stabilizer, m, and convert them to the new stabilizer whose elements are u, m, u dagger. Okay? But are we actually allowed to do that? Well, the new stabilizer still has to be an abelian group. So let's think about that. Suppose we have m and n that commute. Does it imply that u, m, u dagger and u, n, u dagger commute? Well, yes, it does. And that's actually pretty easy to see. Because u, m, u dagger times u, n, u dagger, well, we have a u dagger u here, so we can kill those. And this is equal to u, m, n, u dagger, which is equal to u and m, u dagger, because n and m commute. And then we can stick back that u dagger u and get back u, n, u dagger times u, m, u dagger. So these two things can meet also. And of course, this is if and only if. Okay, everyone see that? So at least if we replace m by u, m, u dagger, we still have an abelian group. But is that enough? Well, no, because we didn't define the stabilizer just to be an arbitrary abelian group. Well, there was this other property that it couldn't have minus 1 in it. But that's actually not going to be a problem either here. What is a problem is that we defined it to be a subset of the Pauli group. Okay? So if we take an arbitrary U and do this operation, we won't get Pauli group elements. So that motivates looking at this more restricted set of operations. So this is the Clifford group. The Clifford group, sometimes also called the normalizer group, I'm going to write it as C sub n. And it's going to be some n-qubit thing, just like the Pauli group could be on any number of qubits. And we want to define it as a set of operations which have this property that when we conjugate by u, we'll take Pauli elements into Pauli elements. So it's a set of u, unitary u, on n qubits, such that u, p, u dagger is in the Pauli group for all p in the Pauli group. Okay? Okay, so let's work this out by thinking of some examples. I want to describe the space here. mixture started as black, but it'll end as white. Let's take a very simple example. What about the Pauli group itself? Well, so suppose we have P and Q in the Pauli group, and we calculate P, Q, P dagger. Well, so P dagger is plus or minus P. That's kind of not going to be very important. But P and Q, well, they're either commute or anti-commute. So this is minus 1 to the P dot Q, where P dot Q here is this symplectic inner product that tells us whether they commute or anti-commute. And then we get Q, P, P dagger. And of course, this is equal to the identity. So what we see is that P is in the Clifford group. And what more than that, does a very simple transformation. It just changes the sign. So the Paulis change the phases. Okay? So that's a pretty trivial example. Everyone understands that, right? So let's think of a more non-trivial one. It turns out the Hadamard matrix is also in the Pauli group. So now maybe I'll use the scratch space that I prepared. So let's see that. Well, let's calculate Hx, H dagger. Okay, so we get those 1 over root 2s out front, so we get a 1 half. We get 1, 1, 1, minus 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. And of course, H dagger is equal to itself. Okay, so let's multiply these two. So we have 1 half, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And these two we get 1, minus 1, 1, 1. And then multiply these two together, so we get 1 plus 1 is 2, divided by 2. It's going to be a 1. We get minus 1 plus 1, 0. Here we get 0 again. And then here, what do we get? We get minus 1 plus minus 1, divided by 2. So that's minus 1. This is equal to z. So h, if we conjugate x, we'll take it to z. And well, we know that h is equal to its own inverse, right? So h, z, h has to go back to x. Okay. Well, I don't need to calculate I, right? Because u, I, u dagger is always going to be equal to I. So what's left? Well, there's y. Okay. But it turns out we don't have to calculate y either. Because y is equal to I x z. And we can do the same trick we did before and insert a u dagger, in this case h h dagger. So this is equal to I h x h dagger h z h dagger. Everyone see that? And h x h dagger, we've calculated that, that's z. And h z h dagger, we said that was x. And of course, z and x anti-commute, so this is minus y. Okay? And this, we didn't have to calculate in matrices. It just followed from knowing what h x h dagger was, h z h dagger. And you can see that, in general, that's true. That it's enough to calculate. So for the Clifford group, it's sufficient to check that UP U dagger is in PN for some generating set of P's to the generating set for the polygon replacement segment. Right? And then any other element of the poly group is a product of these things. And so using this kind of rule, we can figure out its relation. In fact, the action of U is going to be completely determined. So, well, let's write it down here anyway. So Y goes to minus Y. Okay? So some more examples. So we have the pi over 4 phase gate. Let's call that R, which is, call it R pi over 4 before. It has this matrix up to overall phase. And it turns out, well, okay, first of all, this is diagonal. So it should commute with Z. So conjugation should leave Z alone. But X, it turns out, goes to Y, if you calculate it. And, well, y, as it happens, will then go to minus x, I believe. Okay, so this is also the Clifford group. Another thing we can look at is the control not gate. And it turns out this is the Clifford group, too. And here's what it does. It takes x tensor I. It's now a 2-qubit operation. So we have to check it on the 2-qubit poly group. X tensor I goes to X tensor X. Z tensor I goes to Z tensor I. I tensor X goes to I tensor X. And I tensor Z goes to Z tensor Z. Okay? So here are some nice representative elements of the Clifford group. Maybe I'll just add one more. Permutations of qubits. Right, so clearly you can see that if you permute, so maybe you have to think about it a little more, but if you conjugate by some u, which permutes the qubit, that's just going to permute the corresponding poly matrices, right? So x on the first qubit will go to x on the second qubit, for instance, if you swap the first two qubits, and so on. But actually, it followed from C naught being in this, because you can write permutations as some sequence of C naught gates. And this Clifford group actually, I mean, it's not an accident that I called it a group. It really is a group. And you can see that, again, by the same kind of manipulations we've done before, that, well, so if UP, so if U is in the Clifford group, UP U dagger is in the poly group, and then if you conjugate again by V, right, you get V UP U dagger V dagger, which is the same as conjugating by VU. So if U and V are both in the Clifford group, V times U is in the Clifford group. And you can see inverses are in because the left-hand side and the right-hand side are both poly, so you can go back and forth. So in fact, it is a group, and it's enough. And it turns out, we'll show this in the second half, that the C naught, the Hadamard, and the pi over 4 phase gate will actually generate all elements of the Clifford group. Okay. So one more note I want to make. So I guess two more notes. So remember, we only need to think about a generating set of polys. So for the Hadamard phase gate, I wrote everything. For the C naught, well, there would have been 16 things I have to write if I wrote all the polys. So I just wrote a generating set. And what you see for 2 qubits is just these 4 things, right? Because, well, there's also X tensor X, but you could write that as this times this, right? And so clearly X tensor X, we'll go to this times this, which is X tensor I. And similarly for things like X tensor Y or just Y tensor I, anything like that, you can write as a product of these things. So the other thing that's maybe worth noticing is that for these transformations, overall phase of u disappears, right? Because if you have some phase e to the I theta up front, well, then u dagger is going to have e to the minus I theta. And so they kill each other. And so you'll get exactly the same transformations, whether you have u or e to the I theta u. So frequently, we'll kind of be sloppy as to the exact definition of a Clifford group. And sometimes we'll be talking about Cn defined here, and sometimes we'll be talking about Cn with these phases modded out. Okay, that's the center of the Clifford group. Okay, and usually I'm not going to have to be very careful about making a distinction. You have to choose the right one. The reason I defined it this way is because I want the Pauli group to actually be a subgroup of the Clifford group. And the Pauli group does have these phases. Okay. And there's one other place where it comes up, although I don't think we'll talk about it in this class. Maybe we'll. But a lot of the time, we can just ignore these overall phases for most of the things we want to do with the Clifford group. So that's just a kind of minor technical definitional issue. Okay, so I think that's a good time for a break. And then we get back, we'll talk more about the Clifford group, a lot about its properties, how to do the encoding circuit, things like that. Oh, but before we go, a question.
Yeah, so how do we know that H, R, and C naught generate the Clifford group?
Oh, well, you don't know that yet. I'm going to show that next time, or the second half. You know because you trust me. Okay, thanks. So we'll get back in 5 minutes.